Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. On today's episode, we will be discussing The Brothers Karamazov, Book 8, Chapter 4. Hey, what's this? Uncle Drosselmeyer has linked a YouTube clip. Things are becoming frightening. Here's something according to the atmosphere of the chapter. Dance Macabre by Camille Saint-Saëns. Well, I can't listen to that, Uncle Drosselmeyer, because of copyright things. But thanks for the link. The questions I asked you guys about the chapter were these. Mitcher did a murder. Maybe. Do you think he killed him? And do you see Mitcher as a straight-up obsessed maniac? Or is there more to him than that? I think he's a straight-up obsessed maniac, personally. I am Norwegian said, Mitcher did a murder. Do you think he did it? Time skipped from when the old caretaker grabbed Mitch's leg to when he fell to the ground, bleeding from the head. We have no idea what happened to Fyodor either. I was spoiled on one event, trying to get a handle on the characters early on, so I won't say any more. Did you read one of those character breakdowns which ends up spoiling the plot? I am Norwegian. Yeah, that hurts. That sucks. A few people did that with War and Peace as well. Okay, either way, says I am Norwegian, things are looking real bad for Mitcher. He's left a trail of witnesses and painted himself in the very worst light. He's also painted himself with blood and taken a handkerchief soaked in blood in his back pocket. Rookie mistake. Question 2, do you see Mitcher as a straight-up obsessed maniac, or is there more to him than that? I don't see him as a maniac at all. We all carry the potential to do this kind of stuff. Dimitri is particularly, let's say, passionate, but I don't think he is insane or anything, nor do I think he's intended to be bipolar like some people have brought up earlier. Keep in mind that Dimitri today is basically Zossima in his youth. I think I wrote that question under the impression that he bludgeoned, what's-his-face, to death. But now there seems to be some confusion about whether he actually did kill that guy or if that guy fell down or something. And you're right, it was a bit vague. Dosto's done a number on us. He's made it so we can't be sure. The unreliable narrator thing. God damn it. But as I have talked about before, says I am Norwegian, Mitcher is ruled by his shadow self. Zossima became aware of that shadow and obliterated it in a moment with God's light, rendering him completely harmless. Jung said something like, what kind of man are you if you don't even cast a shadow? And at first, that's how people treated him, as a harmless, holy fool. I'm getting off track. Point is, largely, normal people commit awful, awful acts all the time, especially when love and jealousy are involved. Few of us are individuated enough to be in the driver's seat all of the time, especially not at the extremes of emotion. There's a reason temperance has been thought of as a virtue in basically all philosophical and religious thinking. Huh. Techrific said, very, very important point, that Dimitri is today what Zossima was in his youth. And Zossima was certainly redeemed by the end. Soma Stars said, just to clarify, I wasn't saying he was bipolar. Tech had asked if Dimitri's character came across as believable, could he be a real person? I was just saying, yeah, he resembles a bipolar person in a manic state. But I wasn't saying he is bipolar. Sorry for the confusion. Makes sense to me. Soma Stars also said, I found the time/chapter split with the first sentence saying something like, and after Mitchell was done. Without the whole story, there is room for manoeuvring, and it does lead one to think Mitcher murdered Fyodor. Yeah, that's completely what I thought happened. Wait, no, Fyodor? Wait, who did he murder? Oh no. He murdered the other guy. It was Fyodor's servant guy, wasn't it? Grigory. Yeah. Henry Loz 70 said, it was not very clear to me what happened. I think something else happened to him, and Mitchell will get blamed by the bloody clothes and the weapon and the shouting and the running. Yeah, it doesn't look good for him. Uncle Drosselmeyer said, first thing, I'm not pretty sure if the line Dmitri quotes, and naught but the whispering silence belongs to the poem Ruslan and Lyudmila by Alexander Pushkin. It is some folkloric tale about the rescue of the princess Lyudmila. The poem is a parody about the cavalry genre, something grotesque, sarcastic, and with ambiguous characters. I couldn't find the complete poem, but the style seems to fit Dmitri. The second thing, I found this interesting. He waited 2 minutes, his heart was beating violently, and at moments he could scarcely breathe. Mitya remembered afterwards that his mind was at that moment exceptionally clear, that he took in everything to the slightest detail, and missed no point. Here, Dosto is describing a rush of adrenaline in Mitch's body. The adrenaline release can lead to heart rate acceleration and strengthen or consolidation of memory due to stressful events. Maybe Dmitri is an adrenaline junkie. He loves intense situations, risky behavior, substance abuse, crime, violence. All that's too much testosterone, Mitcher. All I can say is that Dmitri is an interesting and complicated case study. I am not putting a tag on the character, I am just enjoying Dostoevsky's craft. Laura Weiss-Ditch said, the narrator is making sure we remember certain details, but then ended up skipping over what actually happened. Dosto is a master of making us feel frustrated and need to keep reading. Well, on that note, let's keep reading. Let's read the first half of chapter 5, A Sudden Resolution, right after I take this sip of water because my mouth is dry. Refreshment. All right, let's do this. She was sitting in the kitchen with her grandmother. They were both just going to bed. Relying on Nazar Ivanovich, they had not locked themselves in. Mitya ran in, pounced on Fenya, and seized her by the throat. Speak at once. Where is she? With whom is she now? At Mokroi? He roared furiously. Both the women squealed. I'll tell you. I, Dmitri Fyodorovich, darling, I'll tell you everything directly. I won't hide anything, gabbled Fenya, frightened to death. She's gone to Mokroi, to her officer. What officer? Roared Mitya. To her officer, the same one she used to know, the one who threw her off over 5 years ago, cackled Fenya, as fast as she could speak. Mitya withdrew the hands with which he was squeezing her throat. He stood facing her, pale as death, unable to utter a word, but his eyes showed that he realized it all from the first word, and guessed the whole position. Poor Fenya was not in a condition, at that moment, to observe whether he understood or not. She remained sitting on the trunk as she had been when he ran into the room, trembling all over. Holding her hands out before her as though trying to defend herself, she seemed to have grown rigid in that position. Her wide-opened, scared eyes were fixed immovably upon him, and to make matters worse, both his hands were smeared with blood. On the way, he must have touched his forehead with them, wiping off the perspiration so that on his forehead and his right cheek were blood-stained patches. Fenya was on the verge of hysterics. The old cook had jumped up and was staring at him like a mad woman, almost unconscious with terror. Mitya stood for a moment, then mechanically sank onto a chair next to Fenya. He sat not reflecting, but as it were, terror-stricken, benumbed. Yet everything was clear as day. That officer, he knew about him. He knew everything perfectly. He had known it from Grushenka herself, had known that a letter had come from him a month before, so that for a whole month, this had been going on a secret from him, till the very arrival of this new man, and he had never thought of him. But how could he? How could he not have thought of him? Why was it that he had forgotten this officer like that, forgotten him as soon as he heard of him? That was the question that faced him like some monstrous thing, and he looked at this monstrous thing with horror growing cold and with horror. But suddenly, as gently and mildly as a gentle and affectionate child, he began speaking to Fenya, as though he had utterly forgotten how he had scared and hurt her just now. He fell to questioning Fenya with an extreme preciseness, astonishing in his position, and though the girl looked wildly at his blood-stained hands, she too, with wonderful readiness and rapidity, answered every question, as though eager to put the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, before him. Little by little, even with a sort of enjoyment, she began explaining every detail, not wanting to torment him, but, as it were, eager to be of the utmost service to him. She described the whole of that day in great detail, the visit of Rakitin and Alyosha, how she, Fenya, had stood on the watch, how the mistress had set off, and how she had called out of the window to Alyosha to give him, Mitya, her greetings, and to tell him to remember for her, to remember for ever how she had loved him for an hour. Hearing of the message, Mitya suddenly smiled, and there was a flush of colour on his pale cheeks. At the same moment, Fenya said to him, not a bit afraid now to be inquisitive, "Look at your hands, Dmitri Fyodorovitch. They're all over blood." "Yes," answered Mitya mechanically. He looked carelessly at his hands and at once forgot them and Fenya's question. He sank into silence again. 20 minutes had passed since he had run in. His first horror was over, but evidently some new fixed determination had taken possession of him. He suddenly stood up, smiling dreamily. "What has happened to you, sir?" said Fenya, pointing to his hands again. She spoke compassionately, as though she felt very near to him now in his grief. Mitya looked at his hands again. "That's blood, Fenya," he said, looking at her with a strange expression. "That's human blood, and my God, why was it shed? But, Fenya, there's a fence here." He looked at her as though setting her a riddle, a high fence, and terrible to look at. "But at dawn tomorrow, when the sun rises, Mitya will leap over that fence. You don't understand what fence, Fenya, and never mind. You'll hear tomorrow and understand, and now, goodbye. I won't stand in her way. I'll step aside. I know how to step aside. Live, my joy. You loved me for an hour, remember, Mityanka Karamazov. So, forever." She always used to call me Mityanka. Do you remember? And with those words he went suddenly out of the kitchen. Fenya was almost more frightened at this sudden departure than she had been when he ran in and attacked her. Just 10 minutes later, Dmitri went in to Peter Ilyevich Perhotin, the young official with whom he had pawned his pistols. It was by now 8:30, and Peter Ilyich had finished his evening tea and had just put his coat on again to go to the metropolis to play billiards. Mitya caught him coming out. Seeing him with his face all smeared with blood, the young man uttered a cry of surprise. "Good heavens, what is the matter?" "I've come for my pistols," said Mitya, "and brought you the money. And thanks very much. I'm in a hurry, Peter Ilyich. Please make haste." Peter Ilyich grew more and more surprised, and suddenly caught sight of a bundle of banknotes in Mitya's hand, and what was more, he had walked in holding the notes as no one walks in. No one carries money. He had them in his right hand and held them outstretched as if to show them. Perhotin's servant boy was, who met Mitya in the passage, said afterwards that he walked into the passage in the same way, with the money outstretched in his hand, so he must have been carrying them like that, even in the streets. They were all rainbow-coloured 100-ruble notes, and the fingers holding them were covered with blood. When Peter Ilyich was questioned later on as to the sum of money, he said that it was difficult to judge at a glance, but that it might have been 2,000, or perhaps 3, but it was a big, fat bundle. Dmitri Fyodorovitch, so he testified afterwards, seemed unlike himself, too, not drunk, but, as it were, exalted, lost to everything, but at the same time, as it were, absorbed, as though pondering and searching for something and unable to come to a decision. He was in great haste, answered abruptly and very strangely, and at moments seemed not at all dejected, but quite cheerful. "But what is the matter with you? "What's wrong?" cried Peter Ilyich, looking wildly at his guest. "How is it that you are all covered with blood? Have you had a fall? Look at yourself." He took him by the elbow and led him to the glass. Seeing his blood-stained face, Mitya started and scowled wrathfully. "Damnation, that's the last straw," he muttered angrily, hurriedly changing the notes from his right hand to the left, and impulsively jerked the handkerchief out of his pocket. But the handkerchief turned out to be soaked with blood too. It was the handkerchief he had used to wipe Grigory's face. There was scarcely a white spot on it, and it had not merely begun to dry, but had stiffened into a crumpled ball and could not be pulled apart. Mitya threw it angrily on the floor. "Oh, damn it," he said. "Haven't you a rag of some sort to wipe my face? So you're only stained, not wounded. You'd better wash," said Peter Ilyich. "Here's a washstand. I'll pour you out some water." "A washstand? That's all right. But where am I to put this?" With the strangest perplexity, he indicated his bundle of 100-ruble notes, looking inquiringly at Peter Ilyich, as though it were for him to decide what he, Mitya, was to do with his own money. "In your pocket or on the table here? They won't be lost." "In my pocket? Yes, yeah, in my pocket, all right. But I say that's all nonsense," he cried, as though suddenly coming out of his absorption. "Look here, let's first settle that business of the pistols. Give them back to me. Here's your money, because I am in a great need of them, and I haven't a minute to spare." And taking the topmost note from the bundle, he held it out to Peter Ilyich. "But I shan't have change enough. Haven't you less?" "No," said Mitya, looking again at the bundle, and as though not trusting his own words, he turned over two or three of the topmost ones. "No, they're all alike," he added, and again he looked inquiringly at Peter Ilyich. "How have you grown so rich?" the latter asked. "Wait, I'll send my boy Plotnikov's. They close late. I'll send my boy to Plotnikov's. They close late, to see if they won't change it. Here, Misha," he called into the passage. "To Plotnikov's shop, first rate," cried Mitya, as though struck by an idea. "Misha," he turned to the boy as he came in, "look here, run to Plotnikov's and tell them that Dmitri Fyodorovich sends his greetings and will be there directly. But listen, listen, tell them to have champagne, 3 dozen bottles, ready before I come, and packed as it was to take to Mokro. I took 4 dozen with me then," he added, suddenly addressing Peter Ilyich. "They know all about it. Don't you trouble, Misha." He turned again to the boy. "Stay, listen, tell them to put in cheese, Strasbourg pies, smoked fish, ham, caviar, and everything they've got. Up to 100 rubles, or 120 as before. But wait, don't let them forget dessert, sweets, pears, watermelons, 2 or 3 or 4, no one melon's enough, and chocolate, candy, toffee, fondants, and in fact everything I took to Mokro before. 300 rubles worth, with the champagne. Let it be just the same again. And remember, Misha, if you are called Misha, his name is Misha, isn't it?" He turned to Peter Ilyich again. "Wait a minute," Peter Ilyich intervened, listening and watching him uneasily. "You'd better go yourself and tell them. He'll muddle it up." "He will. I see he will. Eh, Misha? Why, I was going to kiss you for commission. If you don't make a mistake, there's 10 rubles for you. Run along, make haste." "Champagne's the chief thing. Let them bring up champagne. And brandy, too. And red and white wine. And all I had then. They know what I had then." "But listen," Peter Ilyich interrupted with some impatience. "I say, let him simply run and change the money and tell them not to close, and you go and tell them. Give him your note. Be off, Misha. Put your best leg forward." Peter Ilyich seemed to hurry Misha off on purpose, because the boy remained standing with his mouth and eyes wide open, apparently understanding little of Mitya's orders, gazing up with amazement and terror at his blood-stained face and trembling, blood-stained fingers that held the notes. "Well, come now, wash," said Peter Ilyich sternly. "Put the money on the table or else in your pocket. That's right, come along, but take off your coat." And beginning to help him off his coat with his coat, he cried out again, "Look, your coat's covered with blood too." All right, you know what? That's a good spot to end for today. Kind of a random spot, but it's as good as any. we've sent Misha off on his little errand, and yeah, cool. All right, let's see where this goes from here. Sorry for the random place to stop, but yeah, we'll continue tomorrow. We'll read the rest of the chapter tomorrow. All right, have your say about part one over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Thank you very much for listening today, and I will see you tomorrow.